They say that brevity is the soul of wit. While the introductions of our head table dignitaries are not necessarily guaranteed to reflect wit, we do think that they'll be the briefest on record. Now, we've kept them brief deliberately for three reasons. Number one, most of them, I think, are old friends of industry and government officials in the audience. Second, we have provided a rear screen slide to elaborate on their identities. Thirdly, as you know, the group that had the meeting before us didn't break up till 12 o'clock and we're running just a little bit behind time. So in keeping with this spirit of brevity, I would ask that our head table dignitaries remain standing until they've all been introduced. Then if the audience wishes to join me in applauding our distinguished guests at this time, or at that time, it'll certainly be appropriate. First, Mr. J.A. Reidelbach. Mr. J.B. Albee. Mr. Donald H. Gott. Mr. J. Edgar Kennedy. Mr. James E. Nolan. Mr. Henry Willens. Mr. Boyce Price. Mr. E. Howard Gatewood. Mr. Thomas T. Snedden. Mr. George Romeiser. Mr. Charles A. Gillette. Slow. Can't see it. Going too fast for him, all right. Are we caught up? Mr. Philip T. Farnsworth. Mr. Stephen F. Dunn. Mr. Wendell B. Barnes. Mr. William S. Bromley. Mr. Julian Cheatham. Mr. John S. Richards. Mr. William Swindells. Mr. Thomas J. McHugh. Please let me join me in giving a hand to this great group here. Now on my right, Mr. Frank J. Hanrahan. You know, this was all set until the follow-up and getting the room arranged. Have we had Mr. Hanrahan on?
Yeah.
Right. Mr. Robert O. Hawes. Mr. Robert E. Doherty. Mr. William A. McGraw. Mr. William H. Shike. Mr. Clark E. McDonald. Mr. Fred Hornaday. Mr. James F. Steiner. Mr. Ari Broderick. Mr. Robert A. Rowland. Mr. Robert F. DeGrace. Mr. J.J. Maroney. Mr. Howard D. Bennett. Mr. Robert E. O'Connor. Mr. Peter Terzik. Mr. Stuart Ferguson. Mr. Russell H. Ells, Mr. Lauren L. Stewart, Mr. Arthur Temple Jr., Mr. Gene C. Brewer, Mr. Charles T. Gray, and Mr. Mark Townsend. Please join me in applauding our dignitaries. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure for me to introduce our president, Mr. J.B. Edens, president of Southwest Forest Industries, Phoenix, Arizona. Mr. Edens.
Thank you, Mark. On behalf of the 17 federated associations, the numerous sister organizations, and the hundreds of industrial families in the ranks of the National Forest Products Association, I wish to welcome you all. It took me until just recently to teach these speech writers how to write you all. And about that time, the nominating committee this morning decided to throw me out of the office, so I hope that my successor is a Southerner, or else he'll be in trouble too. Mark could be brief if he wanted to, but this is my last opportunity, so I'm going to take my time in spite of the importance of the dignitaries to my rear. Sincerely, I hope you all share an element of pride which we would like to pass along. That is, today's leadership luncheon has attracted over 1,000 NFPA members and guests, the largest such gathering in the long history of our national association. With us today are many government officials, most of whom work directly with executives of our forest and wood products companies and our association. Also on hand are many representatives of allied industries and professions who share with us some of the problems of our industry. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, there are many. And we are delighted to see here many friends from the news media, from the agencies and offices of government, and others from the Congress. Many of you on hand today are in the direct firing line of government responsibilities. Others are staff executives, those behind the scenes authorities who get things done and without whose dedication this huge government machinery would grind to a halt. Today in our nation, some 750,000 Americans work full time in the manufacture and distribution of lumber. Wood and wood products are important businesses in every one of the 50 states, and in fact, practically every city and town in the nation. Since 1776, our lumber industry has produced enough lumber to build a boardwalk 6 feet wide that would stretch from the earth to the sun. And you know, even if all our trees were to stop growing today, and all imports of wood and lumber were stopped, this nation would have enough trees to meet the current demand in the United States for the next 62 years. American forest products people are a rare and wonderful breed of people. In what other industry does the businessman invest and reinvest toward a yield which cannot be harvested for the next 25 to 50 years? America today grows more timber than it harvests. It is appropriate that we gather in the reflected heritage and traditions of our forest industries, because our forest industries are as old as this nation of ours itself. It is, in fact, this nation's first industry. When our founding fathers established their foothold on the frontiers of this new world, the forests were virtually all that God provided them. And these early settlers ambitiously used their forest. They used them for fuel, for shelter, for tools, for protection, and even for one of the first articles of commerce. This story of the forest industries is as legendary as Paul Bunyan, and as fine a tribute to free enterprise as our pioneers conquering a continent, clearing farms, building cities, harvesting and converting an untamed, unrelenting wilderness into this remarkable reward for human initiative. The story of greatness of America and the story of our forest industries are one and the same stories. On behalf of the entire industry, I want to thank you for your contribution to that story and to that greatness and for being with us today. And now we introduce our discussion subject. In order to ignite much-needed dialogue, which seems to ask, is our traditional private sector today leading, following, or being led? Thank you.
Now, in some ways, our subject matter here today is perhaps several years ahead of its times. Although what one might call the alert, penetrating, intellectual, scholarly, and forward-looking elements of our thinking society have been expressing concern, or at least interested in the matter, the majority of us have been too concerned, too busy, too occupied to have this concept nag and annoy our reason. As you know, today's panel discussion asks this question: is the private sector of our economy being phased out by government? Some say our private sector has lost to government by default, the business community either being too tongue-tied or suffering from a leadership laryngitis brought about by mixed amounts of apathy and atrophy. Noted economist John Kenneth Galbraith said, "Functions accrue to the state because, as a purely technical matter, there is no alternative to public management." Henry Ford II said, "As our society has grown more complex, the government has had to play an ever greater role. That trend is not likely to be reversed." In the June 1963 issue of Harper's, Irving Kristol said this, quote, "The liberal community, that is, the teachers, the journalists, the civil servants, the trade unionists, the leaders of minority groups, and so forth, envisages the welfare state as the one institution through which it can exercise power and authority over the nation's affairs," unquote. While he was president of the Carnegie Corporation of New York, and before he became the nation's secretary of health, education, and welfare, John Gardner said this in a talk called "The Anti-Leadership Vaccine," quote, "We have all seen men with lots of bright ideas, but no patience with the machinery by which ideas are translated into action. As a rule, the machinery defeats them. And it's a pity, because the professional and the academic man can play a useful role in practical affairs, but too often he is a dilettante. He dips in here or there, he gives bits of advice on a dozen fronts, and he never gets his hands dirty working with one piece of the social machinery until he knows it well. He will not take the time to understand the social institutions and processes by which change is accomplished," unquote. In his very thought-provoking book called Reclaiming the American Dream, Richard Cornell offered these fragments of insight, quote, "The conservatives can win public attention by pointing out the failures of the government, but they can offer no specific alternatives. They can only whine about the side effect of big government, as one might complain about the mess left by the firemen who put out a fire." He also said the veteran liberal finds himself imprisoned. He can either abandon his idealism, as many now do, or he can continue to promote big government, desperately hoping that the next federal program may somehow be better than the last. "The independent sector," he went on, "will grow strong again when its leaders realize that its unique, indispensable role in America is to compete with government. It must, he said, be as eager as government to take on new public problems. It must be imaginative, vigorous, and persistent. In a recent speech, our first Vice President, Gene Brewer, President of the U.S. Plywood Corporation, suggested that the private sector and government may not indeed be competitors. Perhaps they are, in fact, partners. As he phrased it, the government takes nearly half of the profits of business, 48% today. And if this isn't being a partner, I don't know what is. At this time, it gives me great pleasure, then, to introduce what has to be considered one of the most distinguished, most learned, most interesting groups ever assembled in a city where discussion is certainly not a stranger. As we proudly proclaimed in our promotional literature, they represent, and we quote, four of the most notable figures from Capitol Hill. Politically and philosophically, their backgrounds and beliefs represent a wide range in the spectrum of contemporary opinion and action. Each is a newsmaker in his own right. Our notable panel members first, a widely known Senate liberal who has matched philosophies with conservative colleagues over a career span which embraces education, public service, and writing. He's the author of several books, including A Liberal Answer to the Conservative Challenge. He came to the Senate in January of 1959. He serves on two top Senate committees, Finance and Foreign Relations. And in 1964, his high standing in his party and the respect of his colleagues were reflected in the fact that he was nominated as a Democratic vice presidential candidate. Ladies and gentlemen, the senior senator from Minnesota, the Honorable Eugene J. McCarthy. Our next panelist has come through the ranks of public service by way of the ranks of business. He is a former chairman of the board of Ballard & Ballard Company of Louisville, Kentucky. He was first elected to the United States Senate in November of 1956. He is a member of the Senate Committees on Finance and Commerce, is the former chairman of the Republican National Committee, the former Assistant Secretary of State, and in 1960 received his party's nomination as candidate for Vice President. Ladies and gentlemen, the junior senator for Kentucky, the Honorable Thruston B. Morton. Our next panelist came to Congress in November of 1952. He is chairman of the Republican House Conference Committee and the ranking minority member of the House Appropriations Committee. In 1964, he was chairman of the Republican Platform Committee. Last year, he was singularly honored by former President Dwight D. Eisenhower when the former chief executive named him as one of the 10 citizens best qualified to be President of the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, the Honorable Melvin R. Laird, Congressman from Wisconsin. The fourth panelist is from everyone's favorite city, New Orleans. He was first elected to Congress in November of 1940. He is now the third ranking Democrat in the House. Since 1962, he has served as the Assistant House Majority Leader, better known as the Whip. He is the third ranking member of the House Committee on Ways and Means and chairman of the Joint House-Senate Subcommittee on Foreign Economic Affairs. Since 1955, he has been vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and in 1964, was the parliamentarian at the Democratic National Convention. The Honorable Hale Boggs of Louisiana. Now, if there's such a person as Mr. Moderator, United States of America, the one person to properly stimulate as distinguished a panel as we have here today, it would have to be the next person I will introduce. He is the panelist and the producer of the oldest network television program on the air, NBC's Meet the Press. He He has gained international regard and respect for his tenacity in extracting answers from often reluctant world leaders. Our moderator came to broadcasting by way of Harvard education, and he has broadened his education with the late H.L. Mencken on the famed American Mercury magazine. Chances are that he was instrumental in many a sleepless night for most of us, because among his many successful magazine ventures were such nerve tinglers as Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Lawrence E. Spivak, and Mr. Spivak, it's your meeting. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've met our experts. I'm sorry.
Your power is off, and you wanted to reduce this. Would you please put the power on?
Are you able to hear us all right? Be too bad if you didn't. I'd hate to get involved the way a friend of mine once did. He was lecturing, and a little man in the rear of the hall got up and said, "I can't hear a word he says." Someone up front got up and said, "I can hear every word he says, and I'll be glad to change places with you." Are we set to go? Terrible if you just heard us and couldn't see us. Ladies and gentlemen, you've met our experts and you know our subject. At the heart of this discussion are two things: freedom and economic security. How best can the individual get a maximum of freedom and economic security in our complex society? By more government or by less? And where do we stand today? Do we have too much government in our lives, or too little, or just about enough? Most important, of course, what of the future? Where are we heading? Now let's start with Senator Morton for his answer to the broad question of today's subject. Is the private sector of our economy being phased out by government?
Well, Mr. Spivak, first, let me say that we've been through a technological revolution in this country and in the world, indeed, in the last two generations, the like of which humankind has never seen. This obviously brings the federal government into closer touch with our daily lives, and this we cannot deny, regardless of our wishes. To the specific question which is before us, we actually saw in the 50s and since then some phasing out of direct government operations in competition with the private sector of the economy. But the trend for so many years has been that the private sector is so influenced by government, controlled by government, that decisions that are made normally or were made in the marketplace or were made in the office of the vice president in charge of sales or merchandising are today being made, many of them, at a bureaucratic level in Washington. And this indeed puts a severe strain on the energy, the imagination, and I think the future growth of the private sector of the economy. The private sector has its responsibility, the government has its. I don't want to see them out of balance. I'm deeply concerned by the fact that today we are debating bills, all of them have the name Truth in them somewhere or another. That's like being against motherhood, to be with a bill with the name Truth in it. But all of these are transferring decisions that are made in the marketplace or executive administrative decisions made at the level of the entrepreneur and transferring that to a bureaucracy here, which I think will tend to put a break on that which made us great, a compelling will to create.
Senator McCarthy, can we hear from you on that broad question?
Well, Mr. Spivak, I think we're very quick to say that somehow freedom and security are inseparable.
You have your mic on.
You don't have any control. Can I be heard?
I think not. Do you have, is there a mic of yours behind you? You're
no, you don't have it.
Sitting on something?
I have it, though.
I plead not guilty.
You thought that would be a good way to work this panel.
Dale, once a man has been Republican National Committeeman, he's not really fit for civilian life. You gotta watch them all the time in order to phase them back in.
I thought that was working out very well.
It was. I see.
I gather so.
There weren't a few Democrats back there to protest, or I'd have lost this whole program. The basic question of freedom and its relation to security, of course, has been the matter of not just government, but the concern of philosophers, I suppose, throughout the history of Western civilization. It's not always been a question of individual freedom as opposed to the power of government. This same issue has been raised in times past with reference to the relationship between almost any well-established institution in society. There was a time when the church was the great concentration of power, and it was a threat to individual liberty and individual freedom. There have been times in the past, and even in recent times, in which the great concentrations of economic power, if I can go back to medieval times, the feudal system, was one in which the concentration of economic power in the hands of the feudal lords was unquestionably a threat to the not just the individual liberty, but the economic freedom of the men who were made subject to that economic system. In our own time, we are inclined, I think quite properly, because of the great concentration of power in government, to look upon government as the principal threat to individual liberty and freedom. Memory of the Nazis and the current knowledge we have of communism quite properly forces us and requires that we give attention to this. But I don't think it ought to move us to consider that every action on the part of government somehow constitutes a threat to individual liberty. On the contrary, that again, the testimony of history is that oftentimes the recourse was to government in order to protect individuals from exploitation and from loss of liberty to other forces which were operating in society. To whether or not the second half of the 20th century in the United States, the power of government is in fact a threat or is denying individuals of genuine freedom and of real liberty. I suppose it's an open question. One can make projections that the movement is by way of restricting liberty. It's my judgment that at least under the current relationship is one which is in balance, and that you have had government creating areas of freedom and of liberty for individuals, opportunities not just in the social and the educational field, but also in the economic field, that it does not at the present time constitute a real and a present danger to either economic liberty or any of the other basic freedoms which are the objectives of government and all of the institutions of American society.
Congressman Ladd, do you think the private sector of our economy is being phased out by government?
I don't think there's any question about it. All we have to do is look at the facts of the last 10 years. We find that our population has increased by 18%. Private employment has increased by 16%, but government employment has increased by 46%. And I think if we look at it on the basis of the facts, one can come to no other conclusion than the private sector is being phased out by government. I think it's well for us to remember what Thomas Jefferson warned us of, that the natural progress is for liberty to yield and for government to take over. And I think that's what's happening in our society today in the Great Planned Society of 1966.
Congressman Boggs, we'll hear from you on that question.
Yes. I think that Senator Martin put his finger on it when he said that in the last generation, we had a technological revolution in this country. We have indeed had one, and the country has grown astonishingly. As a matter of fact, when President Wilson became president, the gross national product of this country was $40 billion. Today, it approaches $725 billion, and soon it will be $1 trillion. That's the most astonishing phase-out of business that I've ever heard of. Now, the technological revolution, of course, has brought about problems that must be faced by a national government, by a central government. For instance, when we put 10 million automobiles on the highways a year to maintain this vast automobile industry, we must have an interstate highway system conducted on a national basis. When we invent electronics, television, radio, we can't control it in the city council. We tried it, as a matter of fact. We had to establish the Federal Communications Commission. But we didn't take over television or radio. We simply attempted to bring order out of chaos and make it possible for you to tune in one station without having a dozen others interfere with you. The same thing goes on. The very technology of our society today requires trained people. Requires trained people in your business. A few years ago, you didn't need as many college graduates as you need today. Today, a man's hands, as such, his brawn, is worth very little. His brains are worth a tremendous amount. So that we've had to increase expenditures for education at every level, and so on throughout our society. As I see it, with more private employment in the entire history of our country, with less unemployment, with profits greater than they have ever been, and incidentally, the reports in for the first quarter of 1966, they're higher than they were in 1965, and 1965 was a record year. I can't see any phasing out.
Senator Martin, what do you consider government's legitimate function in a free society? If a problem that affects a large section of the public can't be solved by the individual or a group of individuals outside of government, think that problem should go unsolved, or that government must seek to find a solution?
Well, I think that government has a responsibility and must seek to find a solution in those areas in which they can't be solved otherwise. And I think various levels of government have to be put in proper perspective. I'm one who always believes that the best solution to a problem is that that's closest to the problem, closest to home, so to speak. I don't go marching into the Senate every time I pick up a paper and see a headline about something that's gone wrong, a juvenile delinquency or a peanut surplus or something, with a huge federal band-aid to take care of something that might be solved by a drop of mercurochrome applied in time at home. But there are examples. For example, let's take the REA, Rural Electrification, which I think probably has as much support in the Congress today from both sides of the aisle, rural and urban people, as any program. The utilities obviously could not go up with electricity into the hill country, into the sparsely settled areas, and so this developed as a government responsibility. And with a 2% interest, which at that time was more than the government was spending, it was having to pay for its money. Then it gets into generating facilities. So it still borrows money at 2% for generating facilities. This is bringing up problems in the Congress today. TVA, when in the mid-50s, the Congress refused to give it any more money to meet its expansion and its needs in its own area. We finally passed a bill in 58 that allowed the TVA, proscribed its area, then allowed it to go to New York or Chicago or wherever, San Francisco or any financial center, and sell their own bonds, raise their own money. But the thing that disturbs me is that indirectly, through more advantageous interest rates, let's say, through priorities, let's say, whatever reason, that we are getting the federal government into controlling decisions, which I think have made us great and made our system great because they've been controlled by competitive forces and not by bureaucratic forces.
Senator McCarthy, what would you say the criteria should be for limiting the government?
I don't think there's any absolute standards you can apply. I don't think the generalization such as that the government should do only what the people cannot do for themselves or cannot do as well is universally applicable. I think it's a good general guide. There certainly are some things that the people or subsidiary institutions of government or private effort cannot do. The obvious one is we couldn't really farm out the Defense Department, but nobody's advocating it very strongly. Question of what the government can do or the people can do as well as the government can do is one in which there is, of course, open debate. And you also then move on to the question of that which probably the private sector could do better if it were to do it. That sometimes we're forced to move in because of neglect. It's not a question of usurpation. Certainly, I don't think there's any question but what, under ordinary circumstances, the private electrical industry of this country might have taken care of the problems of REA. The fact is that they did not do so. There were a number of forces. I don't mean to fault them altogether. Remember that this was depression and that there were economic pressures running against the electrical companies then, which we don't seem to remember today. But here was a case in which you had government moving to do something which I think was good for the country. If you'd applied the absolute rule that this could not be done by anybody else, you would have had to say no on that basis. If you had to apply the rule that could not have been done as well by the private sector, you could have had a good debate. But if you raise the question of whether or not it needed to be done, and it could be done by the government, then I think the answer was relatively simple. And this, in my judgment, is the kind of practical set of rules that you have to apply in any circumstances. If we could move over to the general welfare field, I'd just like to raise this question, a point that most of the programs we have now as national programs, retirement programs, unemployment benefits, medical benefits for the workers, these were not programs that were first developed by the government and then imposed upon the country as a whole or upon industry. Nearly all of these programs were developed in the great corporation of the country. They gave us an example. You had a kind of corporate feudalism developing in this country, and eventually others began to look at what was happening in General Motors. I didn't realize how right Charlie Wilson was when he said that what was good for General Motors was good for the country until I looked at their welfare program. It was far ahead of anything that we had ever proposed for the country as a whole. So you take these concepts of basic programs to give some security to the individual, develop first of all in private industry in this country, in private corporations, and begin to give them some kind of universal application for the good of the country as a whole. I go one step farther. I think it's good to have basic national programs for all employees. It's good for industry not to be obligated with this burden, industry by industry or corporation by corporation. And I think it's good for the individual worker that he have some individual and personal security in these programs which he can take with him. So that if he wants to move from one corporation to another, he doesn't have to sacrifice the benefits which he had accumulated through years of work under one banner or in the livery of one corporation. Good for the corporation, but also contributing to the individual freedom and liberty of the individual, not just the workman. We might even apply this to corporate directors and officers.
Congressman Ladd, the federal government today is a purchaser of goods and services. It's a supplier of free goods and services. It's a revenue collector. It's a producer and a seller. It's a money lender and a guarantor. It's a subsidizer, and it's a regulator of business. Now, where would you have government stop?
Well, first, I would reevaluate the 200 grant and aid programs which are currently in existence as far as the federal establishment is concerned, the federal government. At the present time, we have these 200 grant and aid programs, and as a result of them, most of the decisions that used to be made by our state legislatures, our city councils, our school boards, are directly made by federal administrators here in Washington, D.C. I would hope that a plan, I have introduced legislation several years ago, and Walter Heller has come along and supports this kind of an approach in the last year or two, to make block grants to the states, to give the individual states the opportunity of making the decisions as to how these funds would be spent. I believe the kind of direction and the superimposing of bureaucracy here at the Washington level over the state and over the local school boards is a great mistake, and I do not believe we get a dollar's worth of service for each dollar that is sent back to the states. Not only do we have these 200 programs that are dispensing $14 billion in this fiscal year, 1966, but the federal government now, through the Department of Labor and other departments, is moving into other areas to control. Take, for instance, in the unemployment compensation field, in which my state, Wisconsin, was the leader, adopting the first law of 1932. Here, the Department of Labor, again wanting to move in and exercise direct control, do away with experience rating, establish federal standards. This, I think, is a direction in which the federal government should not be moving, and I think it's time for us to reevaluate the present 200 grant and aid programs that we have on our statute books today. And I hope a proposal, as was suggested to the President by Dr. Heller, can receive bipartisan support and consideration in some future session of the Congress.
Congressman Boggs, I think it's we all agree that government has grown greatly during the past 30 years, and we agree that business has grown. I think the big question is, has government grown faster than it should, and how much more has it grown than business? Now, I think in 1933, gross national product was roughly about $150 billion. It's running at the rate now of
1933 is about $40
billion. Oh, no, sir. I think I checked that. It's about $150. I think it was about
$150.
1933? 1933. Hate to disagree with you. That was a bad year, but the figures are just the figures that I say.
Wasn't even close to $140 billion. But go ahead with your
the
question.
Government was five. The government had a budget roughly of about $5 billion. Our business figure, our business gross national product today is about $730 billion, and our federal budget is about a little over $100 billion, despite the fact that about 55 of it is defense arm. Don't you think that that does indicate that business has not grown as rapidly, despite the fact that it has grown rapidly?
Well, Mr. Bivak, first, I hate to disagree with you, but this is something that I deal with every day, these figures. And I can tell you that the gross national product of the United States in 1954 didn't approach you $150 billion.
Be that as it may,
I think that the point you're making is, has the amount of government, has the amount of the public sector increased at a greater rate than that of the private sector? That's the point I think you make. The answer, as I see it, is emphatically no. Look at it from every point of view. First, from the standpoint of the national debt. Now, the national debt at the conclusion of World War II was over $300 billion. And the expenditures on the part of the, our gross national product was less than $300 billion at that time. Today, the national debt is a little more than $300 billion, $325 approximately. The gross national product, as you said a moment ago, is $750 billion. In effect, this means that a man who at one time was spending as much as he was earning, we're now earning more than twice of what we owe, which is a very significant gain indeed. In addition to that, the whole thrust of the federal take in the economy is actually being reduced when you look at the entire economy, and that's the important thing test to take. McGraw-Hill, which is a conservative organization, last year made a study in depth trying to project the economy of our country 15 years hence, and of course that's very significant in light of the subject for discussion here today, namely is the private sector of our economy being phased out by government. And McGraw-Hill came to the conclusion that, number one, that in 15 years, the gross national product would approach $1.5 trillion, a fantastic amount of money, that the growth of the federal sector, and I have the figures right here, would be something like 38%. The growth of the other sectors, private, state, and local, would be much greater indeed. So that, assuming that they have made this study accurately, and I have every reason to believe that they have, then the prospects are for not the government private economy being phased out, but more of the government being phased out. Now, I don't argue with some of the statements made by Mr. Laird or by Senator Martin. They're talking about administration. They're talking about maybe abuses that have grown up. The other side of the, and these should be corrected by Congress, I might say, without that in the 8 years that the opposition party was in power, not only were none of these programs changed, but the amount spent by the federal government continued to go up precipitously, as you know, Mr. Speaker.
When were those 8 years that we were in power in Congress? I'd like to know those 8 years.
Well, your party was in power in the executive
branch. That must have been a long time ago.
And as a matter of fact, we... Well, I might say, if you want to make a partisan point of view in that connection, you've been in power. You've been in power 4 years in the last 33 years, which indicates the American people don't have much use for your point of view.
I'd like to get down to some of the specifics in this thing, Senator Martin.
Mr. Spivak, I am not too, I agree with my friend Hill Boggs in the fact that I'm not too concerned about the ratio between our debt and our gross national product. I am troubled about our gold reserves, as I know he is, as a very responsible member of the Ways and Means Committee. But in the development of this great, all these federal programs, what disturbs me is that we kill that which made us. We always brag about ourselves being the greatest people in the world, the greatest country in the world, this, that, and the other, and properly so, make our 4th of July speeches and our political speeches and our speeches before service clubs and whatnot. But where do we come from? I come from a state where bloodlines are rather important in the horse business anyway. We're going to see what happens Saturday. I don't know. We got a few lame ones down there now. But we came primarily from Western and Central Europe, so they must be great people. We're a temperate zone, they say. Well, the temperate zone runs around the world twice, once in each hemisphere. We've got great natural resources, yes. Of course we have. I dare say that if the subcontinent of India or the vast continent of Africa is ever fully developed, well, you'll find natural resources that rival those of this continent. So there's something else. I don't know how to define it. It's been a compelling, a rather burning will to create, a will to produce, which I fear is being somewhat softened by some of the problems that we have today. I spend more time in Washington, D.C. than I do in my home city, as do my colleagues, because we have long sessions of the Congress. We see here today third generation on relief. I don't blame them, I blame the system. I brag about the great pride, the great independence of the Kentucky Mountaineer, the Appalachian region. I have more of Appalachia in my state percentage-wise than any other state, except West Virginia. And yet I see, even there, a hesitancy to take a job at $18 or $20 a day, which might not be the union scale in the coal mines, but still it's a pretty good wage in that area because of the red tape of getting back on the rolls again. Now, these aren't pleasant things to say, but these are facts that I think we have to face. How many young men today that are getting out of college or out of even graduate school want to be president of, let's say, the Weyerhaeuser company or some great company in this industry here? How many of them are beginning to think that business is somehow not the best career, that there's no great pride in it, there's no great feeling of loyalty, that this is just a fight between this group and that group, and there's something a little bit suspect about it? All of this begins to disturb me when I see more and more decisions made not in the competitive marketplace, but in an office here in this great city.
Senator McCarthy, what is your explanation for the growing welfare roll, despite the fact that we are now in the greatest period of prosperity that we ever have been?
Well, I don't know that I'd say there's a growing welfare roll. There are two things, I think. One, that we've come to accept what I think Senator Martin just pointed out,
we were on the verge in this country of accepting a kind of institutionalized poverty when you get to the point where a third generation is on relief. And the poverty program, which is subjected to so much criticism now, was a rather almost a desperate effort to prevent the kind of freezing of this institution into American society. We find it very difficult to break up what had come to be a kind of pattern of life. This is one aspect of it, the decision that this was perhaps a critical time. We had to make a great effort to try to prevent this from coming about. The second, of course, is that we've raised our general standards of living everywhere. We have the potential to meet the needs of people. We take the education program we now have in effect. It is directed to see to it that no talent is wasted in America, that those with the great talents shall have those talents developed and used, but we've gone over to the other end of the spectrum and said that even the retarded and those who have the least intelligence among American people, that these shall be given an opportunity to develop insofar as they can. Well, once you have the potential to meet needs of this kind and you begin to reach out to try to do it, it gives you the appearance of having broadened and deepened and greatly extended the welfare program.
Well, do you say that the growth of our welfare rolls has nothing at all to do with the fact that the politicians know that they can get votes and get power through voting money that way?
I don't think you get many votes from those who are actually on relief. I think you may get some votes from people who are concerned about the welfare of the underprivileged and of those who are denied in American society. But the charge that this is a direct appeal to those who are on relief is not borne up by the general statistics you get with reference to the manner in which the poverty class in America responds at the polls. If there is a political response to this, it's on the part of people who have a humanitarian instinct and a concern for these people rather than for those who are the beneficiaries. And I could comment on this question of ambition. I think the statistics show that Americans are quite willing to work. The problem we get talked about now is there aren't enough people that everybody's working. What's happened to these 4 or 5 million people who didn't want to work, or 4.5% of the people who supposedly didn't want to work? All of a sudden, we find they all want to work. We don't have enough unemployed, we're told by some economists. Was this a sudden change that took place? Was it a question of how the earth rotates?
What is your explanation?
Well, I never held that this was...
Welfare rolls if everybody's working.
Well, there aren't more people on welfare rolls. We're trying to do more about the people who are on...
I think our welfare rolls in almost every city...
We're spending more money. But we don't have more people on...
Congressman Laird, we're making
a greater effort.
Well, first, with all apologies to my distinguished colleague from Louisiana, I'd first like to say that perhaps it was those 4 years in which the minority party was in office, and I didn't bring up the fact that there was any 8-year period. We were a little old-fashioned. We went along with the idea perhaps that government should live within its income, but those were the only 4 years in which we really had a balanced budget in which expenditures were brought in line with revenues, and I think that meant a lot to the soundness of the dollar in America. Now, if I think there's one thing that the business community should be interested in, that is that we maintain the respect and the soundness of our dollar, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. Now, that might not be a very popular political issue in this year, 1966. Maybe it won't make much in the way of votes and voter impact. But I think that it is of great concern to everyone in this country. And it seems to me that members of Congress and, yes, representatives of the executive branch want to go out and blame the businessman for the wanting to make a profit. They want to blame the laboring man for seeking an increase in his wages. They want to blame the farmer because of the cost-price squeeze that he's faced with for inflation. But the real blame for the inflation and the lack of soundness in our dollar today rests with government and the fiscal policies of this government. And it seems to me that those of us in the Congress on both sides of the aisle better take note of this, or the United States of America isn't going to be too concerned about this question that we're discussing today. Because whether the private sector or the government sector is running things, if we're running it with a dollar that isn't worth very much, this question isn't going to be of great interest to many people in America.
Congressman Boggs, we've heard a great deal. Would you like to comment on who's responsible for inflation, whether it's government policies, or do you want to place the blame on the private sector?
One might say that was a leading question.
I'll go along with that.
I think that there are many elements here that one has to examine objectively. To begin with, everyone admits that there is heat in the economy, and everyone wants price stability. Now, until quite recently, we have had the longest period of relative price stability that we've ever had in the history of this country. At the present time, we have tremendous activity in every segment of our society. The amount of consumer spending, for instance, is enormous. Let's say that we cut $1 billion off an education program to provide trained people to run a space program or a missile program or even in technology having to do with forestry. And at the same time, we continue to generate a tremendous consumer demand and tremendous investment potential on the part of business, all of which I approve of. I voted for the 7% investment tax credit as well as the tax reductions for business. The government aspect of it alone would not take all the heat out of it. What I'm saying is that this is a joint enterprise, the question of price stability in our country. Now, I'll say further that if it is shown that affirmative action on the part of the government is needed, both in the reduction of expenditures, maybe the imposition of taxes, even possibly the use of controls, I don't think that Mr. Ladd would want to do these things. And it certainly has not been established by economists that the federal segment of spending in our country today is alone responsible for the heat in the economy. As a matter of fact, the increase in spending right at the moment at the local and state levels, relatively speaking, is enormously higher, relatively, than the federal expenditure. Now, there are reasons for it. In my town today, we're having a vote on new sales taxes to build additional schools to send our children to. The median population in my congressional district today, one of the oldest in the country, is 25 years, which means that we have an enormous number of children to educate. Well, we've got to build the schools, and they're being built by the public sector. So the point I make in answer to Mr. Ladd's contention is that this is a matter of joint responsibility, not only on the part of the national government, but on the part of local governments, state governments, consumers, business, and labor.
Senator Martin, there was a recent Newsweek poll, and 96% of the people interviewed said that the free enterprise system has made this country great. Now, in view of that, what's your explanation for the increasing demand on the part of the public for government solutions to more and more of our problems? And there has been an increasing demand. More than half of the people interviewed believe that business cares little for the individual, and more than half approve of the way government is regulating business. Do you think that business, the free enterprise system, or the private sector has failed to meet some of the social responsibilities that it should have met?
I don't think you can categorize it one way or the other, but certainly you can pick out individual cases on both sides. You can show those companies that have been forward-looking and have assumed responsibility in this sector, and you can find others that have been negligent or slow to assume a responsibility. I think as a whole, the business community has been, in the last 10 or 15 years, becoming much more conscious of its responsibility in this whole area. And this is a good thing. I think that part of the swing that we took toward welfare and the welfare state, if you want to call it that, which many do, was a result of perhaps 50 years ago a hesitancy on the part of business to take on its share. I can remember years ago when I was a kid when Henry Ford put in the $5 day. And I heard many businessmen say he's going to ruin the country. Of course, it was just the opposite. He created a new market for an automobile in addition to making an automobile that was within the means of so many. This sort of thing has plagued every country in all of human history. But I think that the business community as a whole is perfectly willing to take on its responsibility. And there are those who are recalcitrant. Yes, of course, we still have some who, I get letters today saying, repeal Social Security. Why don't you repeal Social Security? Why didn't Eisenhower repeal Social Security when we elected him president? I get letters like that today that are absolutely, of course, not even worth discussing here. But there are people that feel that way, and some business management probably feels that way, some segment of the business management. But it is in the minority. The mention has been made of the investment credit tax. This was to get our plant up to date with the plants of Western Europe. This was to stimulate the economy. Today we're worried about the economy running away. We talk about job training corps as a big part of the war on poverty. Perhaps it's high time that we considered a tax credit to train humans that are now incapable in our complex society of holding a job, even if they want to, rather than through these expensive camps and whatnot, where we contract it out to private industry to run them, to a direct apprenticeship program there.
I'm talking more of social problems like curing disease and education, eliminating race prejudice, controlling pollution, things of that kind. Can the private sector really get into that? And hasn't the government moved more and more, expanded its work in those areas? And can that be stopped in the kind of complex society we live in?
You take any one of those you mentioned. They go beyond, in most cases, they go beyond the province of local government. The pollution, be it air or water pollution. We are permitting states to make compacts to deal with this problem, but this goes beyond even state lines. We have the private sector of the economy is operating in this field, but the problem is so great that there undoubtedly has to be a certain amount of government participation in such programs as this, at least in the form of leadership and guidelines.
Congressman Ladd, I'd like to stick to this for a minute. During the past few weeks, the country has been hearing a great deal about government plans to give the Secretary of Commerce power to fix automobile safety standards. Now, do you think government would have moved into this problem if the automobile industry itself had assumed its responsibilities? I mean, hasn't government moved into many areas that really belong to the private sector because there has been real neglect? And isn't the responsibility there on the private sector rather than on government?
Well, I think the government has moved into areas such as this because of a feeling among people that legislation and regulation is necessary. I don't believe that Congress will act in this area without sufficient support from the general public, and I think there's public support in this particular area at this time for some sort of standards to be established, and those standards tried to be established in the states, and with the 50 states all getting into this area, some 15 have moved into the area. It has made it very difficult for the automobile industry. I think you'll find the industry coming along with an agreed upon bill simply because in this area, the automobile industry was put in a very disadvantageous position, having 15 states moving into the area and not being able to transport cars across state lines meeting these different standards. And that was not good for this industry, which is a mass-producing industry. And I think the kind of standards which are being agreed upon by the automobile industry and on an agreed-upon basis, I feel will be helpful and keep the price of cars down.
Why then did the automobile industry seek to have the states get further involved. As I remember it,
the states, the automobile industry was faced with a very tough problem in getting 15, if all 50 states set up different standards in this area with the cars being manufactured as they are. I think you'll find that in the testimony given before the House committee this last week, that the automobile industry has come along with an agreed-upon bill. I think the bill will be on the floor of the House within 3 or 4 weeks. It will be an agreed-upon bill worked out with the industry so that they will not have state-by-state regulation as far as each car is concerned and each manufacturer is concerned.
Senator McCarthy, I think in the time that we have left, we ought to cover
I think that's a different problem, though, than we're talking about here. There are certain areas in which because of the kind of production and the kind of production capacity we have here in the United States, certain standards are needed. In the lumber industry is a very good example.
Be careful
We have worked out certain standards as far as lumber is concerned that are accepted by the FHA and others throughout the industry. And this has afforded the industry an opportunity to keep their prices down, to make these standards and to meet these standards throughout the United States. And this has been helpful. I'd like to have the same thing in the milk industry, that any milk meeting U.S. Public Health Service standards can move freely in interstate commerce. Now it can't. Lumber can. This is important. This is a role that the federal government can play. And I think it's important that it do play these roles.
No, but don't you think that if in many industries, like the automobile industry and, say, the drug industry, they had properly policed themselves, the government, there wouldn't be a demand on the part of the public frequently on the part of some members of industry themselves for government action to protect the public.
I don't think there's any question about that. If there wouldn't have been a need for these states to move in the areas that they did as far as automobile safety, they wouldn't have had to move in those areas. Those 15 states would have been silent, but they moved because the industry had not fulfilled its role in this very important area of safety. And with a large number of people being killed on our highways today, this is an area in which the federal government does have a responsibility.
Senator McCarthy, we've heard a great deal during the past few years about guidelines and voluntary controls. How voluntary can any control be when a powerful government suggests you do this or else?
Well, Larry, that's a very hard question. It's one on which I don't think industry itself is very well agreed. It may be that something like the guidelines we now have is the alternative to statutory provision. My own feeling is that the industry would be better off, and certainly the Congress would be better off, if in a number of these areas we gave statutory support to guidelines if we are to use this technique as a means of giving direction or regulating industry and commerce in this country. It's hard to know. It's a question of where you start on things like guidelines. I don't know what the absolutes are. It's like the question of the national debt and so on. Secretary of Defense, in testimony before our Foreign Relations Committee last week, may have set the absolute standard. He was asked about the number of tanks in Latin America. He said there were 60% of the number in Bulgaria. Maybe we count right and left from Bulgaria on everything from now on, in terms of guidelines or inflation or the national debt or whatever it is we're trying to pass some kind of judgment on. The question of the guidelines, I'm not going to fault the government, because really what's been done there is to take a concept which was developed by a Council of Economic Advisors. This had no support from Congress. It eventually was erected into a standard to which industry was expected to comply. And I think industry and business was perhaps a little bit too ready. Maybe they did it because they thought if they settled out of court, we wouldn't pass a law dealing with profits and prices and guidelines. I don't know whether this was wise on their part. Some of us in the Congress were upset at the time of the aluminum difficulty, and that we felt that the guidelines were being used in a way which at least Congress hadn't quite approved, and also that the stockpiles were being used, or threatened that they would be used in a way which Congress had not approved. The aluminum industry people who spoke to us were unwilling to take any action, and One member of our group said, now I understand why they call aluminum a soft metal. So it's not altogether the fault of Congress, really. It's a question of industry responding and of moving this thing in a kind of uncertain area between what is the law and what is the practice. And I'm not prepared to fix the blame clearly upon Congress for guidelines or on the executive branch for guidelines or upon industry and business for the way in which they have responded. Sometimes it's better to keep these things out of court. And I think you all recognize we have a lot of operations in America which are not really illegal. They just kind of operate between the laws.
We pretty well agree here today that government is doing a great deal and has moved into the private sector. The Republican members of our panel here think that it's moved too far. Congressman Boggs, do you think that there is anything that the government is not doing in the private sector that it maybe should be doing or may yet be doing? I mean, or do you think government's gone just about as far as it ought to?
Well, Larry, I like to believe, and I really believe, that the idea that there's a war between our government and business is something that isn't so. And if it is so, we'd certainly better correct it, because the government certainly could not carry on any function unless we had a climate conducive to a healthy business in this nation. Now, I can cite so many examples where the partnership has worked so effectively. Aside from the area of natural resources and the referee function that we all recognize as a legitimate function of government, in science and the development of new techniques, technology, the atomic energy program developed by the government, now shared by industry throughout the country. Now the space program. I had the privilege of talking on the early bird when it first started. This was a joint development by government and business. This has been true throughout the history of our country, the development of transportation and all of its aspects, the aviation industry and many others. So that I like to believe that there's a balance. I thoroughly agree with Senator Martin that bureaucracies tend to feed on themselves, and once established, they're awfully hard to get rid of. And once they have served their purpose, they should be gotten rid of. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But as I see the kind of country in which we live, a tremendous country with tremendous potentials, the government and business, and for that matter, the other segments of our society, must be working together. When you have a battle between them, then the whole country suffers.
I'd like to put one more question for all of the panel before we finish this program. Our time is running out. I'd like to start with Mr. Laird, make it as brief as you can, and then run down the line. And that is, to get at the heart of our discussion today, and that is, do you think that the freedom of the individual has increased or decreased during the past 30 years when government has moved further and further into our lives? And would you say that our economic security has increased or decreased during these last 30 years? Mr. Laird, would you like to take it first?
Well, first, I think that as far as our freedom has grown much less, I think, as in our individual freedom in this country. We seem to put a greater emphasis on peace, economic security, and justice than we do on freedom. Peace, economic security, and justice any individual can have in a federal penitentiary. But freedom is something else. And as government grows bigger, as we have, and I'd like to get back to these 200 federal grant and aid programs in which we have a separate administration here in Washington dictating to the local communities, if they want these grants, just exactly how they're going to run these programs. $14 billion being handed out this year. It would be so much wiser if we'd return to the states a fixed portion of dollars collected in taxes and let those determinations be made at home. We'd have more freedom. I'm interested in having peace, economic security, and justice, but I think the primary goal of our great society should rest upon freedom. And I think that we overlook that many times when we discuss these programs today. And we seem to get ourselves into a position on these federal grant and aid programs where we're willing to sacrifice freedom at home for a buck from Washington.
Senator Morton, do you think we've lost any of our freedoms?
I think that the growth of the federal government, of course, has been somewhat inevitable, as I said at the outset, in our technological revolution. But it was 37 years ago next month that I graduated from college and started in the business world. At that time, the total national budget was 29% of what the interest on the national debt is today. I'll admit I'm getting old, and that's a long time ago, 37 years. But a lot has happened in 37 years, a lot of it inevitable. The events of history, the technological revolution, have all contributed to this. But just because of that our interest today is more than three times our total federal budget when I started paying my first income tax, is going to cause me to examine every problem that comes before the Congress with an eye as to whether this is actually a necessary federal responsibility and something that cannot be done closer to home.
Senator McCarthy.
Mr. Spivak, I think the question of freedom has to be considered in the light of two considerations. One, that which you are permitted to do, and that which you have the possibility of doing. If you apply both of these standards, emphasize the latter today, I think that men are really much more free in terms of what they can do in terms of securing satisfaction and happiness in the world of 1966, certainly than they were in the world of 1930. I suppose the extreme presentation of this freedom position was in some testimony presented to us when we had the medical care bill up by a group of undertakers who said they were against it on the grounds it would disturb the traditional doctor-patient relationship. Well, we tried to reassure them it was just a slowdown, if they could just weather that short period eventually they'd get everybody in the end, but that didn't satisfy them. So it's a question of what kind of freedom you wanted in this particular instance, to have the right traditional doctor-patient relationship or to have a somewhat different relationship, but to have more medical care available to you if you were sick.
Congressman Boggs, you started last, you finished this.
Thank you very much, Larry. I think the question is difficult to answer. Certainly it's difficult to answer on the basis of government relation to citizens. In my judgment, we have greater freedom than we've ever had. Certainly there are rules of the game. We have high-speed cars today, and we have to regulate how fast they travel on a heavily populated area. The Ten Commandments, of course, are a restriction on freedom, as is every logical, good commandment of that type. Now, insofar as our economy is concerned, certainly no one can argue that today, as compared to 30 years ago, our economic situation is incomparably better. We're better housed, we're better clothed, we have better food, we have more of it, we're better educated, we live longer, our lifespan has been extended, we have better medicine, and so on. Whether or not we have a better society is something that I'm not prepared to say. I think that we must build a better society. I don't think government can do that. I think it can establish a climate. But I think a society, what's inside of a man, whether he's a good man, whether he's a just man, whether he's an honorable man, whether he's a compassionate man, whether he's an ambitious man, must be determined in his home, in his school, in his church, and in the community. So I think that we have an opportunity to live in the freest society that we have ever known under the finest economic conditions, if we'll take advantage of them. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope we've answered some of your questions today and that we haven't raised more questions than we've answered. Thank you for being with us, and our thanks also to our guests, Senator Morton and McCarthy, and Representative Bogg and Laird. Thank you all.
Spivak. Distinguished members of the panel, again, thank you for this wonderful afternoon. Thank you very kindly. Finally, I'd like to thank Mr. Charles Gray, President of the American Forest Products Corporation, San Francisco, California, and Chairman of our Association's Government Relations Committee for making this luncheon program possible. Mr. Gray, thank you very much. Our Executive Committee will meet in the boardroom of the Forest Industries Building. In 15 minutes, we'll have transportation out in front of the hotel in 5 minutes. Thank you very kindly. The luncheon is adjourned.